Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts. WSECU's goal is to help make the right card make a difference. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
I guess for starters, how would you summarize the story?
Toad goes to Frog's house one morning, as he often does, and he finds a note that tells him that Frog has decided he wants to be alone that day.
I'm just going to interrupt real quick to say that I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect from KNKX, and I'm with Jenna Moore-Lone, who is the director of the University of Washington Center for Philosophy for Children. Please carry on.
Sure. So Toad, reading that note, starts to get very worried and asks himself, why does Frog want to be alone? Is he unhappy? Does he not want to be my friend anymore? And so he starts desperately searching all over for Frog and finally sees him across the water on an island. So he finds a turtle who he asks to take him across to the island, kind of in a state, and gets over there and says, Frog, why do you want to be alone? Why don't you want to be my friend anymore? And Frog says, yes, I woke up this morning and I thought about how wonderful my life is, including how lucky I am to have you for a friend. And I wanted to be alone today and just think about how fine everything is. And now I'm very glad to see you. And then the story ends that they spend the rest of the day being alone together.
And what are the things that jump out to kids typically?
Often what they'll say is, first, it's sort of a little bit puzzling when Frog says that he wants to spend the day thinking about how lucky he is to have Toad as a friend. Why doesn't he just want to spend the day with Toad then, if he feels so lucky to have Toad for a friend? The children always want to talk, it seems to me, about what does it mean to be alone with someone else? And that often leads to the question, can you be alone with someone else? And can you be lonely whether or not you're with other people? In other words, you can be lonely if you're alone. Can you also be lonely when you're with other people? And often children will say, I think I'm often a lot lonelier when I'm with other people than when I'm by myself. Because when you're with other people and you're not feeling connected to them, you feel lonelier than when you're just by yourself, if you want to be by yourself. And then often children will sort of puzzle about wanting sometimes to be alone and sometimes feeling like that isn't an acceptable thing to say. And so we'll talk sometimes about our society and if we value solitude.
It seems like as adults, as parents and teachers and so on, that we don't necessarily encourage kids to know how to be alone in a healthy way. If they're alone, we immediately want to go help them or keep them company, right?
There are ways in which we don't often take children seriously, that we don't really think that children need time to sit and think and deliberate about whatever's going on for them. We think we need to fill their time with sort of productive activities or whatever, and don't really give them the space to sort of be able to say, no, I need a day just by myself to think.
Does that impulse resonate with you personally?
Oh, it really does. I'm someone who likes a lot of alone time, and sometimes I have felt in my life that is hurtful to other people. And actually, I remember when I was like high school years, and sometimes I would say to a friend, you know, I just really want to be alone. And I remember my father saying to me, oh, you should never say that. And like explicitly saying to me, don't ever say that. It's very rude. Just, you know, tell me you're not feeling well. And I said, I don't think it's better to lie to my friends than to tell them that I want to be alone. And I remember having this conversation with him, and we just really saw it differently.
Could I ask you to read the last, like, couple of pages?
Sure. So Toad gets up on the island and tells Frog that he came over because he wanted Frog to be happy. So here's how it ends. But Toad, said Frog, I am happy. I am very happy. This morning, when I woke up, I felt good because the sun was shining. I felt good because I was a frog. And I felt good because I have you for a friend. I wanted to be alone. I wanted to think about how fine everything is. Oh, said Toad, I guess that is a very good reason for wanting to be alone. Now, said Frog, I will be glad not to be alone. Let's eat lunch. Frog and Toad stayed on the island all afternoon. They ate wet sandwiches without iced tea. They were two close friends sitting alone together.
Alone Together is our theme today on Sound Effect. Whether it's on an island with a toad, in a prison cell, or even in your own head. Those stories coming up right now. Sometimes there's no lonelier place than a crowded bus. I think a lot of us have had that feeling of being isolated even though you're surrounded by people. And it seems to be heightened in a place like Seattle, where the purported Seattle freeze means people tend to keep their distance. Susan Fee had heard that about Seattle plenty of times, but she always knew she still wanted to move back here. She and her husband both grew up in Federal Way, but she had lived in the Midwest for 25 years. Once they became empty nesters, it seemed like time to return to Seattle, and those grumblings that the city had grown frosty in the time since she left were not going to stop her.
So I had already been doing some research and knew of the Seattle freeze. I didn't buy it, though. I thought, I've got the kind of personality, I have the skills, I'm going to crack this code. So we just decided to flip life upside down, and we sold our suburban house, we sold everything. And the other different thing for me was I decided I didn't want to have a car. I want to be a pedestrian, and I wanted to take on the challenge of getting around Seattle and where I had to go by either bus or walking. And I arrived back ready to go, making friends, getting into the community, emailing people, saying hi. And I put a lot of energy into that with little return. The bus culture is interesting. I love it. There's that moment when you do get a window seat or an aisle seat and you sit down and you see people get on the bus and they do that scan, that quick scan of where they're going to sit. And many times there's a seat next to me that's open and they don't take it. Why? I seem friendly. Why don't you want to sit next to me? But many times I'll get on and say hi to the driver and they look shocked. They're just like, why are you engaging? I've never been acknowledged when I sit down. Not even a look. I think that's odd. So I don't know. It's enough to keep my mind thinking about it all the time.
Tell us a little bit more about the 545, like as a baseline. What is the normal feel aboard that bus?
It's the library bus. It is the quietest bus you'll ever be on. Everyone gets on with their earbuds in already, their headsets, and they are occupied. So I had really been trying to make friends, not just trying to get used to my new job and the city, but just trying to reach out and make conversation. And I was starting to feel a little discouraged. And one day I'm waiting for my bus, and first thing I see are all these stuffed animals on the dashboard. They look exactly like a bunch of Care Bears, like 20 of them out there. So the bus opens and the door opens, and before I can be the first one to say hello, which I always am, this bus driver says, "Well, hello! Hello, welcome, come on in." And right away I notice that she has written over the first four windows. She's written her name. There's like neon pink and green and blue and smiley faces, messages all over the front windows. And that's how I learn her name is Bonnie. I call her Care Bear Bonnie. And I think, wow, Bonnie, like, I want to be your new best friend. And so we keep going along and picking up people, and this is the library bus, and so people don't normally engage, and she is engaging. And you can just see people looking around like, what is that noise? What is this thing called talking? And then we get over off of 520, we're coming into downtown, and she takes the mic again, and she starts giving us a little tour. All right, our next stop, downtown Seattle. If you look on the far right, South Lake Union, isn't that beautiful? Like she was doing a tour guide. And you know what? I actually looked. I'd seen that view 1,000 times, but I looked because I thought, she sees something I don't. It just was so apparent to me that I used to be more like that, and I'm not. And she really, in a 40-minute trip, inspired me to just be bold again. Who cares if it just seems way too friendly? And I thought, tomorrow, when I take the bus home, and it's going to be a little bit like my Cheers, right? Everybody knows my name, at least Bonnie will know my name, and I'll have someone to talk to on the way home. But she didn't show up, and she didn't show up, and she didn't show up. I never got her as a bus driver again.
For Susan, Care Bear Bonnie was this magical being who appeared out of nowhere and then, poof, gone, like a ghost. Still, she was so inspired by the encounter that she told a version of this tale at a live storytelling event called Fresh Ground Stories. The story got picked up by the newsletter The Evergrey. People started recognizing Susan at other events and would ask her if she ever found Care Bear Bonnie. Susan, it seems, had tapped into something.
If she had been your driver again, what would you have wanted to say to her?
I first of all would have thanked her for continuing to reach out and talk to people even when it was clear for some they were tired of that. And it didn't stop her. She was brave, and that inspired me to just get up again. I'm going to say hello. I'm going to say goodbye. And I'm not going to give up. I am going to break that freeze and reach out and create a circle of friends. And I will say, through telling the story of Bonnie, that has happened more, for sure.
Could you describe what Bonnie looks like to the best of your memory?
Bonnie is a presence. So she's about 30 years old. She has brown hair, right? No! Are you kidding?
Hi.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
Nice to meet you in person.
Oh, my gosh. I'm going to cry.
That's the point. Surprise.
You guys are so great.
Surprise.
Oh, I wish I had my Care Bear to give to you.
Well, Susan, meet Bonnie. Bonnie,
oh,
meet
yes,
Susan.
We've never been on the same bus again. Yeah, so first of all, I wanted to thank you because I didn't realize until I met you or watched you how much I had kind of given up. You know, that I just kind of let Seattle kind of get to me. And then you just, you know, appeared like this magic bus. And you actually interact. You're everything I wanted to be. And I really wanted to tell you that the next day because I thought you were going to be my permanent bus driver.
Everybody's life would be so much better if everyone was like me.
Right.
No, I'm totally joking.
But I was going to keep up a conversation. Like, I was really looking forward to taking the bus home every day because I thought we'd chat.
We probably would have.
See?
Every day.
Maybe, you know, get a cup of coffee or a happy hour. Like, I really had this whole plan. I was so excited. And then you weren't there and you weren't there and you weren't there. So
now she's making me cry.
But you stayed with me. Even though I didn't meet you, I had you. And because of you, I ended up meeting more people. So it's a little infectious. So I wanted to say thank you.
You're very, very welcome. But I'm going to tell you a secret.
Okay.
So I actually had somebody get on my bus the other day and go, wait, your name's Bonnie? Do you have a nickname? And I went, Care Bear Bonnie? And he's like, oh my gosh, I met Care Bear Bonnie in person. And I was like, I didn't know this was a thing. And I went, have a great day.
One of the things that we were talking about was that taking a chance to smile at somebody or offer a friendly comment or whatever, even though you don't know how they're going to react or whatever, it's a little bit of a leap of faith that you are going to sort of make that person feel better. And I just wonder what it's like to have proof now that the good that you put out into the world really does make a difference.
It makes my heart full of joy that I can actually do that for other people. I mean, I've told I don't know how many different people that bringing a smile and a laugh to at least one person a day is what I consider my job, but I never realized that it was that infectious. You know, you can crack jokes and be a goofball and put stuffed animals in your windshield and write little happy hump day all over your bus or just be an in general nut and then actually have somebody come back up to you and go, wow, hey, thank you. It means the world. Like, I may be having a really bad day, but hey, the show must go on.
What do you think, like, what would your advice be for the average, you know, Seattleite or Seattle area resident, whether they ride the bus or not, how to thaw the freeze a little bit?
Open your eyes, look around. You live in a gorgeous, exponentially beautiful place. If you want to meet somebody, walk outside, people. Stop being so shy. Smile. It doesn't hurt. Your face isn't going to crack. I'm not afraid to wave at people on the freeway and go, hi, all five fingers.
Bonnie Robinson is a driver for Metro, still driving the 545, among others. Susan Fee is a mental health counselor and a storyteller in Seattle. That story was produced by Bethany Denton. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is Sound Effect, where our theme today is Alone Together. Marianne Moorman has been a management consultant, an activist, a storyteller, even a radio host. She's also been keeping a secret. It's about a burden that she's carried around since childhood, one that left her with a scar on her body and many more scars on the inside. A heads up that this story does talk about a suicide attempt. If you want to sit it out, it's about 11 minutes long.
Someone will look at my hand and notice that there's a scar and will say something like, how did you get the scar? And I would say it was a chemistry accident. And then I would not tell them this story. It starts in 1962, and I was in the eighth grade, and it goes to now. Really, the first part of this story is walking home from school and hearing my name called and not being able to find out where that had come from. And then the next day, I go to school and I hear, urch, run, run. And I whirl around in my seat to find out where this noise is coming from. And the teacher goes, what are you doing? She had sort of a cabbage face and it all screwed up. And I said, well, I'm looking for what that noise was. Noise. There's no noise here. And when my mother heard that I had disrupted the class, she was mortified. It was the kind of thing she hated the most because I was a disruptive child, not the kind that she wanted at all. And so my punishment was I was on bathroom duty for a month, I think, which meant cleaning with peroxide, cleaning with Ajax, and Drano everywhere to keep things nice and clean. And then coming home and smelling the sweet leaf smoke from all the neighbors in the yards, I hear, man, man. And I turn around, I don't see anybody, man. Where are you? Everywhere. Well, who are you? Lorenzo. Let's have some fun. Well, I only had one friend at school, sort of, and if you don't have any friends, having an invisible one doesn't seem like such a bad idea. So I was going to play with Lorenzo. Only he was very naughty. He would get me to break things in the house, and we took my brother's Bunsen burner and lit matches and scorched the paint and broke things. But when he had me take a rock and chunk it up at my brother's head, and it was really hard, and I saw the blood trickle out of his ear, I told Lorenzo he had really gone too far, and we couldn't play together anymore. And that was when Lorenzo got mean. And he started saying things like, you're fat, you're stupid, you're a fool. And then he threatened to slice my father's throat. So, you see, I had to do whatever he wanted me to do. I had to obey. And when he took the Drano and put it on the back of my hand and dripped hydrogen peroxide on it, I watched the little blue bubbles percolate. And it was painful at first, but then it felt right, burning my flesh. Drip, drip, drip. He made me cover it up with Band-Aids so Mama wouldn't see it, but finally she noticed. And I told her it's just a chemistry accident. It's not a problem. But her turquoise eyes just flared red, and she dragged me off to the University of Virginia Hospital. They operated on the tendons and the muscles and the grafted pubescent skin from my butt to my hand. They must have figured something out because I woke up in a locked psych ward with this huge bandage about the size of Sputnik on my right arm. A nurse with coiled gray braided hair fed me Thorazine and Stelazine. And one of the old guys gave me my first Marlboro. I learned to smoke there. We kicked back in the day room, smoked, and watched Carl Sandburg read at JFK's inauguration. I was there for about 3 months, and I was so sedated that they sent me home. And Lorenzo came too. I was eventually able to go back to school, and the more I was home, the more Lorenzo came with me and was ugly and started to say things like, "Die, die," and led me into the bathroom and opened the cabinets. Take them, kill yourself, take them. And so I opened up the medicine cabinet and I did exactly that. I took the blue ones and the yellow ones and the pink ones and the green ones and whatever was in there, I took the whole thing. And the next thing I knew, I was waking up in another bed in another hospital. And they had these sideboards like a crib, like an adult crib. And I was looking up at a doctor, and all I could really make out were the nose hairs going to the left, going to the right. But Lorenzo was there, and not only was Lorenzo there for the first time, he had a whole chorus with him. But I was able to go back. I was able to go to high school, graduated, went on to college. Lorenzo came right along with me. Sometimes he behaved himself, sometimes he didn't. But I was able to function, to work in the civil rights movement, to graduate, to go on, to get married. And I had a friend who had come out to Seattle to go to grad school. And she kept encouraging me to come on out. And so I did. And Lorenzo never, ever went away. But when I was high functioning, when I was really busy and I was excited and I was going a mile a minute, I was going faster than Lorenzo. And so that was part of the clue to the whole thing, was just keep moving fast. But I did get used to constantly having a parallel life. I have a parallel life. And then Lorenzo did a whole new trick, and they call it a fugue state. I would be functioning, I would be doing things, and then I would realize I was in some place I didn't know, I was doing something I wasn't aware of, and Lorenzo was laughing. And one night, I became aware that I was standing in the baggage claim of the local airport. And it must have been very late because there was no one else there. There was a guy sweeping a broom, cleaning up, and a carousel going around and around with baseboard boxes. All the boxes the same size. All the boxes had my name on them. I reached in my pocket, and in one pocket I had a boarding pass to Philadelphia. So I opened one box, and I was surprised, and I opened the second box, and I was surprised to open the third box, which was the same as the second box and the first box, And I had evidently flown to Philadelphia and bought 500 Easter baskets. I went and found my car. I got all of the Easter baskets in the car. And I didn't want anybody to find this out. I didn't want to tell anybody about this. So I drove directly to the Goodwill, and I deposited Easter baskets. And then I went home and didn't talk to anybody. Wouldn't talk to my friends. Until a group of them decided that they needed to come and visit. They announced they were coming to visit. They got me to a therapist who has the patience of the beatific, who worked with me and worked with me. And finally I told about Lorenzo. And I said, I just want him to go away. And this therapist bent down and looked at me. And the way that therapists make you look them in the eye when you're not. And she said, Lorenzo's not going away. You have to learn to live with him. And I was stunned. I was absolutely befuddled. I had never had the concept that I had to live with him. I thought I had to get rid of him. And so I started to take the new medicines that the therapist would recommend. I went to therapy regularly. I checked in with my friends. I started to enjoy life again. Lorenzo didn't go away. Lorenzo appears. But now when Lorenzo comes, I can just say, you stay over there. You're in your corner. I am in charge. And so I have looked at the back of my hand, and yeah, I have a scar. But I also have built a life with these two hands. And if I forget that I want to live this life, I look up at the corner of my desk where I kept one green Easter basket where I can put all those memories and remember I want to live.
Marianne Moorman is a member of the National Storytellers Network. We'll link to more of her work at our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today's theme is Alone Together. When she was just 18, Marisa Como Karadji packed up her childhood bedroom and moved to Senegal in Western Africa. She was doing a gap year between high school and college, and she was in a program with a lot of structure and support. But it wasn't long before she started feeling culture shocked and homesick. Back home in Edmonds, Marisa's dad was feeling a different sort of loneliness. He wanted to stay connected to his daughter, but it wasn't like he can go to Senegal for parents' weekend. That's when he thought of a novel way to stay close. Sound Effect's Posey Gruner has more.
Marisa Como Karadji went to Senegal to do an immersion program, but it didn't take long for her to realize that immersion is just another way of saying in over your head. One night, she was sitting down to dinner with her host family.
And we're sitting on our little stools, getting ready for a plate to come out, and I look over and there's a scorpion walking up the drive. And I was like, oh, hey! And they were like, oh, yeah, no big deal. And then just took, like, a sandal and smushed it.
Marisa was a teenager who had taken off to a foreign country, and she says that everything felt new all day, every day. Sometimes she could take it in stride.
And then there's just, you just hit those points where it's just like, oh my God, like, I really wish I was at my house right now watching a movie with my family or something like that, you know.
When she wanted to feel just a little bit normal, she'd go to the local internet cafe. She'd choose a computer and pull up a video call.
And I would Skype my mom, I would Skype my dad, I would Skype, you know, my best friend. I would try and get that minute of, this seems normal, you know. But then, of course, it comes in all pixely and, you know, loading, and sometimes it just wouldn't go through.
What I could see her face when it wasn't, you know, pixelating and jumping all over the place.
That's Marisa's dad, Dan. He says he could tell from her face that things were hard. Not that she would tell him directly.
You know, she put up a brave face and let me, you know, let me know that she was doing fine and everything was going good and she was doing all that. So I kind of, you know, I was still concerned.
Like any parent, he was worried for her health and safety. But he had another concern. Marisa was having so many new experiences, and he couldn't share any of them with her. He was starting to feel disconnected from what her life was like. That's when he came up with an idea for how to stay in touch, something a lot better than a Skype call. Dan drove down from Edmonds to Columbia City. He parked a few blocks off of Rainier Avenue and then walked right into the heart of the business district. He was looking for a place called La Taranga.
I'm glad it's got a bright colored sign because I probably would have walked right by it. And I said, well, there's the sign. And so I went and took a look and I went, wow, you know, I was just...
This is the only Senegalese restaurant in all of Seattle. The proprietor, Mamadou Diakité, says it's probably also the smallest restaurant in Washington. La Taranga is a little bigger than a hallway and a little smaller than an alley.
It's very cozy, though. It's very nice and cozy once you get in here. And then when I get warmed up and then I start playing my African music, so that'll give me more energy, you know.
Mamadou needs the energy because he's the only employee. He's the host and the waiter and the chef. He is also the chief hospitality officer. That's very important to him. Hospitality is practically the national value of Senegal. And La Taranga, the name of the restaurant, actually means hospitality in Wolof. Dan is a very outgoing guy, so Mamadou's Senegalese hospitality was a perfect fit for him. The first day he came to the restaurant, he and Mamadou struck up a conversation right away.
I said hi and introduced myself and just said,
he's like, oh, my daughter, she's in Senegal. I said, no, yeah. And I asked him, where's your daughter? What city is staying? How long he been there? Did he like it? You know?
Dan told Mamadou that he was there because he wanted to try a dish his daughter had told him about, something she ate all the time. It was the Senegalese dish.
Thibaut Deon?
Chebujen is, we call it the national dish, the Senegalese national dish.
And it's fish cooked in tomatoes, a tomato stew with broken jasmine rice served with carrots, cabbage, cassava, and eggplants.
When Mamadou makes his chebujen in this little dark kitchen in Columbia City, it smells just like Senegal.
And this is the cassava.
Dan enjoyed that first meal at La Taranga, and he really enjoyed telling Marisa about it the next time they were together on Skype.
I said, hey, remember that that dish you were showing me the other day? And she, yeah. And I said, I went and had it. And she said, really? You know? So we discussed, and she said, well, what'd you think of it? And I said, that was quite good.
They'd found their touchstone. Marisa wasn't going to be able to watch a movie on the couch with her dad. And Dan wasn't going to be able to watch a Senegalese sunset with his daughter. But they could share a meal together, or at least talk about their meal.
And they gave me questions. Well, how did you do this? And how did, you know, what's that spice and stuff like that?
After that first time at La Taranga, Dan kept going back. The next time, he tried the chebuyap, and then the goat curry. Then they started getting creative. Dan would tell Mamadou about a spice that Marisa was cooking with, and Mamadou would make a dish for Dan that included that spice. Then, after each visit to La Taranga, Dan would call Marisa, and they'd compare notes. It helped them get through the 8 months of separation. When Marisa finally came home from Senegal, her dad knew that he wanted to bring her for a meal, a real meal, at La Taranga.
We shared the food over Skype, but I wanted to share it across the table.
He had one condition. You have to speak in Wolof.
How are you?
I didn't understand a word, but I was just enjoying it. This, it was just so cool that my daughter was doing this, and it was just, you know, my head just swelled. It was great, and so I was very proud of her.
Marisa was grateful to have a taste of Senegal right here at home. Now she comes back with her dad whenever she gets a craving.
Manbaga yasapule. Ak kenklebasho.
Oh.
Today, she orders yassa poulet, a chicken dish with onions and spices.
I'm so happy right now.
Dan orders one of his favorite dishes, the goat curry.
Oh, yeah.
Today, it's made with coconut.
Very good. That coconut is much, it just really adds to it.
When they were far away from one another, the food at La Taranga was a way to connect across the ocean. now that they're back, it's a way to connect across the table. And for Marisa, now the restaurant has another purpose. It helps her to connect with her program mates, who are also back in America and feeling homesick for Senegal. She'll go to the restaurant and snap a photo and send it to them.
Little things like this, you know, being able to send my friends like, hey guys, just had Chaboujin, or just had some chakri, you know, and they're like, oh, that's awesome. Like, oh, I remember that. Oh, do you remember when we did that? You know, it's just, it gives us something to connect back to and kind of touchstone to our experience.
That story from Sound Effects, Posey Gruner. You're listening to Sound Effect, where our theme today is Alone Together. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Now a story about two people who have built a connection in spite of being separated by many miles and some iron bars. Strangely, being torn apart seems to have brought this couple closer together. Here's Sound Effect contributor Max Wasserman.
After two abusive relationships, Shirley Liddell wasn't ready for a third, or any more, for that matter.
I had just resolved myself to the fact that I am going to be living the rest of my life by myself. I was happy. I had a life going. If I wanted to go someplace, I could. If I wanted to shop, I could. I didn't have to worry about anything. I was totally self-sustaining. I'm a very independent woman.
This was about 20 years ago. Shirley had just moved to Washington to be closer to her daughter. She worked the night shift at a market research firm in a Tacoma mall. It was a straightforward job. Then came the new guy.
So at 3 o'clock, here he comes, bouncing in like Tigger. There was no tying that man down. He had so much energy. I guess he had been incarcerated for like 17 years.
His name was Michael, and he had just gotten out for robbery. The other employees were intimidated by his record, but he and Shirley got along. They became friends, joked around the office. After a while, Michael even asked Shirley to become his sponsor. That meant driving him home after work, making sure he didn't get into any trouble, or just talking, which they did a lot.
He was telling me some experience of his life at home, and I cannot imagine being in that kind of a household. It's almost like he wasn't there.
Michael was the youngest of six siblings, his mom a teacher, and his dad a cop. Despite its size, it was a loveless home. As a teenager, Michael was chased out of the house and onto the streets. He spent the next decades in and out of prison cells. It was the total opposite of Shirley's childhood. She practically grew up in the pews of her local church around a loving family.
And I can't imagine a life without that. My life is like that today.
It didn't take long for the two to start dating. Every day on the drive home from work, they'd pull over just to talk. This went on for months. Then, one day at the office, a coworker told Shirley about a problem Michael was having with the respondent.
And so I went out, and I'm looking, and I see Michael, but I'm like, where's your respondent? Did she decide not to do the interview? And he went down on one knee, and I was like, oh, I'm in so much trouble. This is in the middle of the food court, and the whole place went quiet because it was right in the peak of lunchtime. And the girls that work with us in the evenings, they're all there, and there's tears flying out of their eyes. And I'm standing there mortified. And he's on one knee, and I'm like, oh, my goodness. And he said, would you please, please, please marry me? We were married a total of 13 days when Michael went sideways. There was something in his voice. Something was wrong. I said, Michael, just come up to the truck stop and, you know, sit at the counter and have some coffee, and I'll be off in a couple of hours and we can go home and talk. He's like, no, I'm going to go to the bus stop and I'm going to go home.
Michael said he was going to visit his stepdad. It was the first time he had mentioned it.
Of course, being a newlywed, the first thing is, what, you're going to go see an old girlfriend to tell her you're married now, or are you going to throw it in her face, or, you know, what's going on? It just wasn't right. It didn't fit where we were at the moment. you know, this all of a sudden impulsive need to go see daddy and something he hadn't talked about doing before, just bam, there it was, and it wouldn't go away. And then I woke up on a Tuesday and I put the news on and there he was. Career bank robber had been arrested. Then I looked at the TV and I'm like, you big dummy. I was so mad. 3 days later, he finally gets the nerve to call me.
You have a prepaid call. You will not be charged for this call. This call is from
Michael,
an inmate at Monroe Correctional Complex.
You know, I just remember waking up and saying to myself, oh, I got to call Shirley. So I got up, got on the phone. Luckily, they did, like, collect calls. And I called her, and she said, where are you at? And I said, it looks like I'm in jail.
Michael says he woke up in jail with no memory of the robbery. The court records don't do much to clear things up. Michael says he was taking a prescription at the time that was messing with his head. All we know is that he robbed a couple banks, a dye pack exploded on his clothing, and he was later caught trying to escape on a bus. Michael got Shirley on the phone. She was reluctant to visit, but eventually agreed. By that point, Shirley had never known anyone who had been to prison, let alone maximum security. The thought that the man she had just married was about to spend 30 years in one was terrifying.
My daughter here in Washington, she was devastated. She had just gotten to the point where she was starting to trust him because she was abused by my ex-husband. She's like, Mom, you need to go and talk to him and let him tell you what happened and why he did this.
I get sent to Walla Walla. She trucked all the way through the mountains to come and visit me, right? I had no idea any of this was jumping off. And when she asked me the questions, I answered them honestly, you know. And to be honest, she said that she was not planning on coming back.
I just never been in a situation like that before. I really did not know what to do. I mean, his family told me, you know, get an annulment and get on with my life. And that sounded like a whole lot easier to do. But I'm like, God, you sent this man to me. And now he's been taken away from me. And I don't know where I'm supposed to be. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I am really feeling all alone out here.
Shirley was stuck in a game of tug of war, whether or not to stay with the man she loved. By this point, she was already in her 50s. Staying could mean spending the rest of her life in and out of visiting hours. But leaving would have broken her oath. As a person of faith, it all came down to loyalty.
It all comes down to the fact that those wedding vows that we did took us from being me and you to us in one.
When I think about what she sacrificed for me in this situation, there's no way on the planet, if I lived to be 150 years old, that I would be able to pay all of that back. But I'll be damned if I don't put the effort in.
Michael and Shirley's relationship now looks very different from when he was first incarcerated. During the day, Michael repairs wheelchairs, tutors math, and plays the drums in a band. Shirley volunteers at a nonprofit down the street. On the weekend, she goes to church, then drives up the hill to Monroe, where Michael was transferred a number of years ago. Ask him what he loves about Shirley, and he'll go on and on.
She has this voice that, to me, is like sunshine being dripped on honey. That's what it sounds like to me. Her eyes, they have this color that to me are arresting. Arrests a part of my soul and makes it be still.
Michael says he's written over 3,000 poems about Shirley since he's been incarcerated. He's recorded a song from inside prison about how he hopes their love lasts for 1,000 years. Everything Michael does now is for their relationship. Like he's taking all the love he never got and giving it to Shirley.
Nobody in the entirety of my life had shown me that level of love, you know, that level of understanding. And she didn't have to. She chose to do that. You know, I felt rescued. I felt loved. I felt relieved. You know, I felt like I could actually come out of the dark oil that was my life and look at the sun. That's what I felt like.
Strangely enough, prison has done a lot of good for the relationship.
Michael and I, over this long period of time, have talked about things that neither one of us thought we would ever talk about to each other. So spiritually and emotionally, we are much stronger than we were when we first got married. Our marriage has gotten stronger. It's tied together. You can't put breadcrumbs between the two of us. It won't happen.
When somebody asks me, how would you term your relationship with your wife? And I would have to say, and I've said it on a number of occasions, it's a true love story. You don't get no better than this.
When they're not in visits, Shirley and Michael stay in touch through letters. Other times, they talk over the phone, mostly about football.
But I feel like we're being cheated out of a good game because the Rams, I don't even like them.
Okay, well, me neither, because they're in my division and I don't want anybody in my division to win. But, okay, I saw that play, and I agree that the refs missed a good call.
And he did, and he even admitted he did.
All right, I love you, sweetie.
I love you, too. I miss you. I'll see you tomorrow, okay?
Yeah, no doubt. I love you.
And I got money, so if you bring your hungry, I can feed you.
I'm always hungry. Okay, thanks.
I know, huh?
I love you.
You always get your hungry on. Okay, I love you too, and I'll see you tomorrow, okay?
Okay, bye.
Shirley and Michael just celebrated their 16th anniversary. Michael has another 14 years before his release. He's hoping to have that shortened through a petition before Washington's Clemency and Pardons Board. His hearing is set for March.
Sound effect contributor Max Wasserman brought us that story. You can see pictures of Michael and Shirley on our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestedt, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We had help this week from Max Wasserman, Bethany Denton, and Paul Currington. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. Get Sound Effect free on your device every week, sometimes twice a week, when you subscribe to our podcast. Get it on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or wherever else you get your audio. And that includes your smart speaker. Just say, "Play Sound Effect, the podcast." And we love getting your feedback. You can send it to soundeffect@knkx.org or find us on Facebook. We'll be back next week with a special fundraising edition of Sound Effect, exploring Seattle's Harborview Hospital. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.